Hello, everybody, and welcome to another brand new episode of Hey Man, It's Okay. I'm Sky, your regular guy. I'm just here to learn about mental health with you guys.
And I'm Ryan Heapy, your licensed therapist at Newport Beach. Sky, we have another clinician today. I know we've had a series of clinicians lately. This time, a psychologist by the name of Dr. Ryan Dix. He's been a psychologist for over 16 years now. And Ryan, why don't you tell us a little bit about what you do, the program you run? It sounds like you really help the helpers more than anything else.
Yeah, I oversee a program for Providence Health System called No One Cares Alone, which is focused on the caregiver mental health and well-being of all of, we call them caregivers, employees of the organization. And so it's a mixture of different programs and tools and strategies and things that focus on their mental health and well-being. And I've been there for about 12 years at this point, and really I've spent my whole career working alongside hospital teams, primary care teams, have worked alongside physicians, nurses, really my entire career.
Do you feel like there is something different when it comes to the mental health or the well-being of caregivers in particular? I know when, as therapists, we talk a lot about compassion fatigue, burnout, really can really wear on us over time.
Yeah, gosh, I think there's a number of challenges that can present themselves in a healthcare space that can impact, again, physicians, nurses, medical assistants, really anybody. And I think those mixture of factors, at least a few of them that come to mind, is a lot of times they are interacting with people who are sick, whether that's physical, mental, spiritual, the whole mixture of challenges that individuals can face. And that's hard to do that day in and day out. It can be super rewarding, but it can also be just really challenging. And I think, so that's one piece of it that makes it hard. We saw during the pandemic that there was also a pretty significant rise in things like burnout and other mental health concerns within the healthcare population. And I think that's for all sorts of reasons that I'm sure people can imagine and lived themselves. And so those are some challenges specific to healthcare that I think people have found. I know other groups in terms of like first responders and so forth, they struggle with some of those similar components when they're interacting with people and sometimes in their most vulnerable space and needing to step alongside that person. Although again, rewarding in its many ways can be challenging in as many ways as well.
That's got to be really taxing to have to help these people. I'm sure it's meaningful to help them. My little brother, he works in a hospital, and COVID just destroyed his mental health. It was so hard to have to go in and see that every single day and be with people when they were saying bye to their loved one on a tablet. How do you keep yourself going when you're the one trying to help these people with all of these things that are happening?
Yeah, gosh, I think it's a mixture of things. It's practicing what we preach a little bit, making sure that I do everything I can to be active, time with friends and family, doing all of those things, again, that we talk with patients and others about. I think one of the challenging pieces about the pandemic is that people oftentimes didn't have access to some of the ways that they previously coped. And in my experience, some of the people that I've interacted with struggled to get back into the rhythm of some of those pieces, whether that was going to the gym or going out with friends or family, potentially a church or spiritual community, that they got used to being by themselves or being more isolated. And so trying to help people to get back into those activities. And again, that same advice goes for me in making sure that I engage in those different pieces. I also just really enjoy the opportunity to step into hard spaces with individuals and have found that something that's rewarding for me. One of the things I love most is being able to help somebody who's struggling in a space, whether that's a leader who's trying to partner with their team or an individual who's really struggling to access mental health services or just has questions. As I'm sure you've talked about on this show before, there's a lot of stigma, a lot of assumptions, a lot of misinformation around mental health. And I enjoy being able to step into that with them and hopefully ease them in towards getting the care that they need. So that, at least for me, is restorative as part of that process. But again, is a tough space to step into and be willing to walk alongside people in some of the vulnerable spaces.
Yeah. Well, man, thank goodness for people like you in the workspace, because it's definitely necessary. So thank you for doing what you do and serving the other people. It's great.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. Asked me what it's like to sit and talk to people about their trauma all day long. And I often think it's nothing compared to the people that have to be right next to the people when they're going through their worst day, their worst week, when they're really in serious pain or after having a surgery, an accident, any number of things. But it's got to be especially challenging to witness that day after day.
Yeah, I think some of the patients that I worked with over the years, whether those with persistent pain or just terminal diagnoses or other pieces, it's both a challenging space, but it is really an opportunity to sit in a space with somebody, again, at their most vulnerable, that I really feel privileged and felt privileged when I've been in those spaces to be able to come alongside that person. And again, provide a space just for listening or maybe connecting them to a resource or something like that. And I think that's the part when people have said similar things to me of, oh man, that job seems really hard. And it's like, it is. And there's these other parts about being able to be with somebody in those moments in their life that bring a lot of fulfillment in the work that we do.
What are some things that you guys, that you look for maybe in particular when assessing for burnout, or some signs that that you might be picking up on?
Yeah, so burnout was defined in certain kind of ways, so we can certainly talk about those pieces. I think people don't necessarily think of themselves in boxes, obviously, and so it's can be a mixture of symptoms or experiences, if you will. But oftentimes people are going to have some type of lessening of personal accomplishment, so a sense of loss of that. And again, that can apply in healthcare or really any other job of the work that I do isn't accomplishing anything or doesn't fulfill me in the same kind of way. You'll see things that also are really symptoms or behavioral, or some people might describe them as emotional experience or things like that. Increased irritability, hesitancy, or even a reluctance or sometimes full avoidance of going to work or thinking about work or doing. For some people, they historically have been people that would be willing to do extra or do more than might be expected. And so pulling back from that. And then unfortunately, as byproducts of those, they oftentimes can experience just other symptoms, whether that's impacts on their sleep, their impacts on their relationships, impacts on their appetite, and some of those other components. And that ties into one of the other pieces, which is emotional exhaustion. So just feeling like I'm done and really having had enough of that piece of it. And then the other thing that we think about is really like a jadedness, that like a why bother? And so that's, again, there's different symptoms, if you will, or experiences. So one size doesn't fit all when you think about burnout. But those are some of the pieces that we identify for most people, or just like when you're thinking about it, it's changes in behavior that seem atypical for that person. And that's really creates an opportunity for a person to dive a little bit deeper with that individual to just get a sense of, tell me a little bit about what's going on at work. And that's at least an opening. And so that's at least what we train people to notice is this person act in a way that's different. That's really it. There's all the clinical more nuanced pieces of it, but at its most basic level, we really want people to think about, this is how Ryan normally presents, but boy, he's different the last week or two, whether that's virtually or in person or whatever. And that So that's the first telltale sign that at least we encourage people to look out for.
And when you notice that with somebody, what is the next step? What does good treatment or care look like?
It depends on a little bit of what that person tells you if you ask them that question. And so in some instances, it's both trying to get a deeper sense of what the severity, if you will, of what it is that they're experiencing. So there's the severity component of it. There's also how long standing it's been. Is this a recent change? Is this something that's been going on for quite some time? And then getting a sense of is there other symptoms potentially that might warrant some higher level intervention, suicidal ideation, for example. And so hopefully the first step is further assessment, whether you're that person or maybe there's a trusted other that you could connect that person with. And that doesn't have to be necessarily a mental health clinician like myself, although obviously we can do that. But for many people, it's connecting them with a peer that they just feel maybe more comfortable with. If they have an ongoing relationship with that person, they're going to be more willing to divulge or discuss what those concerns might be. And so that person can then serve as potentially a warm handoff into something like a crisis services or something like that if they do discover that somebody is struggling a bit more. So the first step would really just be trying to get a better sense of what's going on with this individual and creating a space for them to share. I think depending upon what you find is then going to warrant what next direction or two you might take.
Yeah. You know, it's really hard as a man to identify feelings if it's not something you're used to doing. What's a good tool that we could use to maybe help someone figure out what exactly it is they're feeling instead of just like mad or happy? How do we help people get more, or how do you help people get more specific as to what they're feeling?
Depending upon what type of background they have regarding emotional expression or emotional experience, what I mean by that is how did they learn to communicate or experience emotions, whether that's growing up or just if they've had other opportunities as they've grown older to learn more about that. Depending upon where they start is going to dictate a little bit on where we go next steps. But for many people, it's helping them. In my experience, it's less that they can do it or know how. It's that they haven't really experienced a space where it's okay to discover or potentially problem solve around what it is that I'm feeling. So there's part of that. But with that, we then just teach them a little bit in terms of identifying what it is that their body is telling them. So they may not know what the word is or what to label it, but pretty much anybody can tell you, my body is feeling this fill in the blank. And so helping them understand that typically things like anxiety would present in such and such, such a way. And so giving them some framework can be helpful. But to me, it's again, creating a space that allows them to really talk about it openly. That's oftentimes in my experience, a lot of the individuals that I've worked with, they just haven't had that before. So it's not a lack of ability. It's just they've never been given the opportunity. There certainly, of course, can be some education and so forth as part of that. But for many people, it's just having somebody that they know isn't gonna mirror back the stigma that potentially they have already seen or experienced. But hey, this is a safe space for us to talk about that. And again, that does not have to be a psychologist. It can very much be just an informed peer or friend. If they have that skill set to be able to provide a space, that oftentimes is most important for people because that's where most people are going to actually go is to their friends and family. They're not going to come to somebody like me. We know statistically they're going to start with some of their peer group.
Yeah, you know, it's actually really funny you say that because I have become that person in my peer group. I cannot tell you how many times people call me and they're just like, hey, I just need someone to talk to. I'm like, hey, I'm here because I've made myself known as a safe space for those people and they feel comfortable with me. And I don't have a license and I feel like I connect with them much better in a territory where they are most comfortable opening up and not like an office setting or something like that. So it's really funny you say that and kind of enjoy being that person.
Yeah, there's lots of different trainings, and we offer some in my organization that are really focused on individuals who don't have clinical training to be able to provide some of that, what I think of as an ability to have an emotionally focused conversation with another person. That's at its most basic level what a lot of those trainings are focused on. Again, this is not treating mental illness. This is not diagnosing mental illness, but I'm a safe space, like you said, to be able to come to that. And that's so imperative because we know that there's not enough mental health clinicians in this country. And we know that for lots of reasons, people can't and won't, in some instances, access them. And we need peers or people alongside them that can provide those resources.
I imagine it's hard for people to even want to talk about anything emotionally at work for fear of the stigma, for fear of maybe not getting a promotion, or any number of reasons I could imagine.
Yeah, that comes back to some of this like systemic or environmental pieces that I was talking about a while ago, which is that then falls on the organization that person's a part of to create a space that's psychologically safe so that it's okay to not be okay. And this is a place where you can talk about that. And that's, I can't overstate how imperative that is for organizations to focus on. And that's everything from making sure that we remove stigmatizing language or remove stigmatizing communications, but also what do we offer in terms of mental health services, or how do we train our leaders, whatever those leaders are called in the respective organization, around mental health? How do we train our entire workforce to ensure that people can have an emotionally focused conversation with another person, realizing that they may not go to mental health or they may not go to their leader, but chances are they'll talk to their peer, or at least their peers will be the ones that notice, hey, he's acting a little different today. And those are those opportunities. But to me, it again comes back to the organization's responsibility to ensure that they do everything they can to facilitate that psychologically safe space.
Now, as you have been, I think I just heard them say you've been a psychologist for 16 years. Where did you see the care of mental health starting to become a conversation? Is this more recent, or has this kind of been trying to get better for a long time?
Oh boy, I feel like it's been getting better over time. And there's
I just threw a curveball, I know.
Well, that's just a big question. For me, in the places I've been, it has been getting better, but still a lot of room for improvement. I think for better or worse, the pandemic did highlight increased mental health concerns and the need to address those. And whether that's Surgeon General's report or anything, it's something that has certainly garnered more interest around things like burnout and so forth. So it's gotten better, but there's certainly lots and lots of opportunities that exist around mental health. So I don't know. It feels like a half answer, but
No, I like it. No, it's great.
And what areas could organizations improve on? What do you think we could be doing better?
Well, I think the organizational culture and focus around the environmental and systemic factors that influence mental health and burnout and wellness remain the biggest areas for opportunity. When you look statistically, a lot of organizations have something like an employee assistance program, so they have access to traditional mental health services through that. But oftentimes, there's more opportunity beyond that, and being able to focus in on some of those pieces that I had listed off a little while ago really takes it to that next level that is beyond, hey, here's a resource, you can use it, but it's like over here and you have to call and access it, as opposed to we're going to look inward and identify what are those opportunities within our organization that might be contributing to whether it's stigma or at the very least not easing people's way in accessing the services that they need. So for me, it's that's the focus. It needs to be looking inward organizationally at what those opportunities are and starting to address some of those pieces. And that's where I feel like more organizations are moving in that direction, but there's, I'm sure, lots of opportunity exists still.
But have you ever seen that show Billions?
Billions?
Yeah. Uh-huh. It's about this hedge fund guy and his therapist / psychologist is like in the next room. And
okay.
She's like the general counsel almost for the company. And
okay.
I've heard of a few companies that do this. Actually, there's one across the street, that huge dental company that has like an on-site therapist. And I don't know, what are your thoughts about that?
Like having an on-site therapist?
Uh-huh.
I think it's less the location, although there can be benefits to that. It's oftentimes, from my perspective, what the model of care looks like. I think one of the challenges that we've seen is that there just, again, is not enough mental health clinicians. And so there has to be focuses on things like brief episodes of care, or thinking of it more akin to a primary care relationship, where you're not necessarily going to see your primary care provider weekly or every other week for a year. You're going to see them maybe for a period of time. And so taking sort of a consultative role, and that's, having not seen the show, I don't know all the context of the reference, but I think that's what you can see organizationally as well, is are there opportunities to partner with leaders around specific initiatives or things like that, but to be able to offer ongoing therapy to whatever size organization, it just becomes, the numbers just wouldn't even work because there's just not enough mental health clinicians in this country to even try that. We know half of the people that have mental health diagnoses in this country don't have access to care. So we actually are way behind in ensuring that access. And businesses, I would imagine, are kind of struggle with the same challenges.
What was it that made you want to get into this field, that made you want to be a psychologist to begin?
I was really interested in kind of what brought people to some of the places that they find themselves. And whether that's personal experiences or just environmental factors or those things, I had some instances growing up that just struck me from a curiosity perspective that just made me really start to wonder what happened to that person to potentially take them to the space that they ended up. And so that was really where it started. And then I had an opportunity, did my undergrad in psychology, and initially thought I would go a direction of law enforcement, but had an opportunity to discuss with a law enforcement their perspective on things, and that provided some additional insights for me. And then had the opportunity to, as one of my training experiences, was at a facility where people with serious and persistent mental illness lived. And so I had an opportunity to interact with individuals who were diagnosed with schizophrenia, significant bipolar disorder, and things like that. And just continued to have curiosity around how people get to where they're at. And then, of course, where are those opportunities to intervene and help individuals either avoid that in a early intervention kind of way, or help them once they've already found themselves there, and again, connecting them to services outside of or after a potential diagnosis or something like that.
That's actually perfect, because that brings me back to a point I wanted to circle back to anyway. You mentioned earlier some classes that your organization offers. Are there classes available that people can take where they can become a better resource without getting the clinical degree in psychology? Like, where can they go to learn how to be a better advocate and learn more resources?
Yeah, there's a number of them. So organizations like NAMI can be a good place to find resources and tools. One of the resources that we offer is Mental Health First Aid. So it's an opportunity for people to take that course.
I have that.
What's that?
I have the Mental Health First Aid certification.
There you go. See, so you can speak to that too.
What is that? I don't know what that is.
Well, the way that I explain it to people is, how do you have an emotionally focused conversation with another person, and providing people with that basic set of skills to be able to do that as a facilitator of it. That's really, and a psychologist, that's how I think about it. It's, you know, more in depth and stuff than that, but it's really just, as Sky said, how do you become a better partner and advocate in supporting your fellow person? And so that for me is, and it's most basic of what it is. But it's really those types of trainings, and there's many others of in addition to that, that provide similar skills. And so those, I think, can be a really important opportunity. The other thing is really just exposing yourself to individuals who are living with mental illness, or, and whether that's volunteering or potentially just engaging with community groups that support or that are made up of people with lived experience. Those could all be great opportunities as well.
That's perfect. We actually have, I don't know if you're familiar with Cody Green, but he is an influencer who lives with schizophrenia, and caught him very early, and he's on meds to help manage his symptoms. But he's been very open about his journey into his mental health and is trying to normalize being around people like this and not vilifying that. How important do you think advocates like that are going to be moving forward?
I think if any of us can have somebody we can relate to and remove any preconceived notions or biases that we have about any group, can be markedly helpful. And so I'm not familiar with that person that you're referencing specific, but for me, there's a lot of power in being able to say, I have an example of somebody in my life who has lived with fill in the blank, whatever, and preferably more than one. And so any opportunity, I think, for people to get more experience or exposure to that, I think can be good. Because as we've talked about, stigma remains a big challenge. And so that interacting with somebody like that can be an opportunity to hopefully reflect on any stigmas that we might carry, that we might be unknowingly perpetuating, or just might be biased by ourselves. And one of the ways that we can do that best is interacting with somebody who we may have those biases about or forth.
How would you suggest someone go about doing that if they're not a clinician?
About which part?
Interacting with different groups, to be around more groups, to understand more about who people are and how you can best help them.
Yeah, so I think NAMI is, as I mentioned already, a great opportunity for people to volunteer and be involved in community activities. So there's been so many other groups, American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, and a number of others that have opportunities for things like out of the darkness walks, or tons of other opportunities like that, that oftentimes incorporate not only advocates and family and friends, but people with lived experience as well. So I think those are opportunities they're public events. They don't require any type of clinical background or anything like that, but give you an opportunity to interact with people with lived experience and their family and friends. And so that's the easiest and most accessible way. I know currently there's a lot of out of the darkness walks that are being hosted, and there's other versions of those that are done by other organizations, but those can be some great opportunities.
Do you ever give any thought as to the way our country goes about treating mental health, and if we could do things better on a bigger system?
Another big question.
As it is.
I think it starts with education, and again, the fact that we don't have enough mental health clinicians in this country. I think that creates a bottleneck that's going to exist until we either address the pipeline or we address how people access the clinicians that we do have. And so that's, at least having been involved in education and so forth as well, that's a gap. That's, again, not unique to mental health. It's something we see with primary care physicians, others as well. But I think starting at that, on the front end of that, and going even further back, part of that is exposing people even earlier in their lives to mental health and creating a space to talk about it. So during their more formative years, whether that kindergarten or middle school or whatever, that they're already exposed to that in a way that creates a curiosity in them that may lead them to being interested in mental health as a career, or at least being advocates for people to move towards that space. I think that's, until we address the supply and demand challenge, it's going to be a tough one, I think.
Yeah, I guess I just reflect on the system, like the amount of psych hospitals, I believe, that were around in the early 1900s, 1950s, and then it seemed like psych meds took over, and now we have like a real homelessness, mental health crisis. I think the recent treatment to that was prison for a lot of people. And now it seems like they're on the streets. And I don't know, it seems like we're never really progressing in actually dealing with real mental illness in this country.
Yeah, that's where a lot of my career has focused on integrated primary care. And that model is built around integrating a psychologist or other mental clinician into a primary care environment so that individuals have access to services in a place that they are more likely to go, as opposed to a mental health office. But it also gives us an opportunity to intervene with individuals who don't have a mental health diagnosis and either are some early signs potentially, or are just there for other things that we know, if untreated or if not optimally treated, could potentially progress into a mental health condition, whether that's poorly treated persistent pain or sleep challenges or any other type of medical diagnoses that we know they're increased risk factors for people to develop mental health. And the reverse of those relationships is oftentimes true also. But it also increases the reach. There were so many people, and men were a big portion of this group actually, that if I was a psychologist and I was in a kind of independent space, they wouldn't have come to see me. But because I was in their primary care home, and oftentimes their physician would, or PA or nurse practitioner would do what we would refer to as just a warm handoff with me, there was already a transfer of relationship that got me in the door, if you will. And so then you have the opportunity to partner with that person in a way they wouldn't have likely partnered elsewhere. So
this would be like a mental health clinician almost in an office next to your primary care physician. Is that kind of like?
So there's a couple different versions of the model. One puts me essentially as a mental health person in the same building, but in a parallel office. And there's some model that talk about that. The model that I primarily practiced under is more of an integrated model. And I would typically see patients in exam rooms. And so they would come in and they maybe were going to see their primary care provider about hypertension or diabetes or fill in the blank kind of medical thing. And as part of that, they either would self-identify or their clinician would identify some other challenge that they felt like I might be able to help with as a mental health clinician. And so then I would be brought in at the end of their visit potentially and would then work with that person on depression or a number of different scenarios. And so it was truly integrated in that I did my best to just be part of the milieu, both in terms of how I interacted with patients, but also in terms of space. I didn't separate myself. I integrated into those environments. Occasionally you had a patient or two who kind of felt like it was weird that, oh, hey, like we're talking right now and there's like an exam table in the corner or something like that. That's not something. And those almost were always people who had experienced therapy in a more traditional model, but they oftentimes were fine with it after they realized like, this is just the model that we utilize here. But that, for me, that was also about empowering the clinicians that I worked alongside that weren't mental health clinicians necessarily, but I saw myself both as an extension of the work that they did, but also giving them opportunities to expand potentially their interest or willingness or comfort in being able to address some of those other pieces because they had a mental health clinician alongside that they wouldn't maybe otherwise do. So I think there's models like that that can help expand access.
This work you're doing is, I mean, it's challenging. It's definitely not easy. Why do you keep doing this? What keeps you coming back? And like, what keeps you going? Because I can imagine it eats up on you regularly.
A couple of things. One is the stories that come in about somebody who you've helped. And they're really, even talking to you about it now, and I'm not even thinking of a specific situation, but my body just, you can feel that kind of hair standing up. There's something uniquely rewarding to be able to help somebody through whatever type of challenge that they're going through. And so for me, those carry me a long way. One of the things that brought me into the work that I do now is recognizing that I can work with a lot of people as a psychologist, but the number of people I can impact if I can help all of the physicians and nurses and medical assistants and finance people and everybody that make an organization run more healthy, just think of how many people they then impact. And so they see more if we think of all those interactions in a year than I could do in 400 years as a psychologist. And so for me, that's one of the parts that's really rewarding about this is being able to scale the work into all of those places. Because again, as one person, there's no way I could help all of those people by myself. But boy, if I can help each person have a emotionally focused conversation with another person, just the ability to scale that is really rewarding for me and results in being rewarding for them also. And so I think those are some of the pieces that keep me doing what I'm doing. There's others, but those are the first couple that come to mind.
Great. Thanks for sharing that. Thanks for answering my question. I know we've been asking you a lot of really big questions today.
It's all right.
What got you into the want to help the helpers? Was it that you knew you could reach more people there? Because that seems like a really big jump to get into something like that and a really brave step.
Yeah, I think it was partly that, but it was certainly seeing opportunities as I saw individuals in treatment, recognizing that there was a lot of opportunity to be had in helping people who helped others. And again, for me, it was really being able to scale mental health in a way that makes it accessible to as many people. Again, that's not that in these interactions, I'm training them to be a mental health clinician or any of that kind of stuff. But boy, if I'm able to impact even 5% or 10% less stigma, potentially for a leader who creates a space for the 25 people that report to them, and not only that, but then they know how to connect that person to a resource if they raise their hand and they're struggling. Those were and remain the parts that drew me to this work and continue to do. I also just like, my brain thinks in systems. And so it's something that I also just find interesting, challenging, but challenging in enjoyable ways for me in terms of trying to find solutions for system level challenges. And so work around burnout and well-being in an organization lends itself to those types of considerations and pieces. And it's a nice blend of parts that also give me opportunities to look at research and look at the literature and see what's out there and interact with people. But I still get to have one-on-one, not in a therapeutic or kind of clinical way, but still one-on-one opportunities with leaders and individuals that capture some of that part that also drew me into being a psychologist, of helping that kind of one-on-one. I still get to do a good portion of that as well.
Why don't we end on what's your favorite coping mechanism, skill, well-being concept?
For me personally,
or just your favorite go-to, or if you could recommend one.
I like that.
Gosh, if I could recommend one, it's just whatever's easy and accessible. I think one of the challenges that I would run into, and this applies to me too, is creating an expectation that it has to be hard or long or take a ton of time in order to be valuable. And so I would have people who, you know, whether they wanted to start exercising or make dietary changes or fix their sleep or whatever, is they would set big, lofty goals. And unfortunately, what we know is, not that we can't, but it's a more challenging opportunity for somebody if they're setting big, lofty goals, at least as here's my starting point. And so time and time again, I when I was seeing patients and in my work now, is really helping people identify what's something that you can access almost anywhere, or that you can provide to yourself in a way that's almost always accessible, that doesn't require, you know, okay, I got to go to that gym for an hour, or I have to go to this huge community event or things like that in order for it to count. That was honestly where I saw and still see the biggest challenges, I think, for people to utilizing any coping skill, whether it's mindfulness, whether it's exercise, whether it's talking to a friend, whether it's cooking or whatever thing it is that they find restorative, is setting an expectation that it has to be big, long, like investment to be able to, for it to count. And that we know from the literature that's not true. And again, for people who are able to implement those small strategies are able to see improvements also.
So make it easy and accessible.
Yeah. And just
not too hard.
Yeah, there's so many examples of that, I think. And it was less about a specific skill for me. Is I would oftentimes just ask the person what they have done historically. And it was oftentimes just a matter of helping them get back into whatever that thing was. It wasn't any bright ideas on my part. It was really just asking them, you know, what did you used to do? And then we could either problem solve the why they felt like they couldn't do it any longer, or just how we might be able to adapt it or to step back into that space. They didn't need my ideas. It was really just helping them connect back with whatever they had utilized before.
Hey, everybody. Sky here from Hey Man, It's Okay. Sorry to interrupt, but we had some technical difficulties, and so that's the end of the episode. I just wanted to thank you so much for tuning in. Please make sure to like, comment, subscribe, follow us online at heymanitsokay.com, and check us out on all social media at heymanitsokay. And until next time, it's okay to not be okay. Thanks, everybody.